We've been looking at the four major inhibitors to believing in God that modern people, not all people in the modern world, but modern people generally face. Looked at the evidence for the existence of God. We're going to look at that again today. We've looked at the problem of evil. How does an all-loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God allow so much pain and suffering, so much evil in life? We're today going to continue on the existence of God, and specifically the conflict or the apparent conflict between religion and science. And then finally next week we'll look at the multiplicity of religions and the problems that poses for us. And my basic point to you over this series is that there are good reasons to believe in God. Not absolute proofs, won't take us the whole way, but there is good evidence to suppose that God exists. It's a reasonable hypothesis to make. To be a theist is to believe that God exists. You are a theist if you believe a higher power, usually an all-knowing, all-loving, all-powerful God, is at work in the world. Is there any direct or even circumstantial evidence that supports this belief? If your belief follows the evidence and the evidence says yes, then you're considered a rational theist. If your belief runs against the evidence, all the evidence points away from the possibility of a God, and yet you still believe, you're called an irrational theist. And as I was saying last week, I think many Christians today believe that they have been taught to believe that their belief in God is irrational. You will hear things like, faith is belief without evidence. No, it's not. That's a ridiculous statement. I have faith that Sally will be faithful to me in our marriage. And my faith rests on knowing Sally and entrusting in her character. I don't have an absolute guarantee on her faithfulness to me or to our marriage, but it's not like my faith is based on nothing. That's true for our belief in God as well. It's not based on nothing. We have been conditioned to believe by the prevailing ideology of our culture in North America and Europe, the Western culture, that the evidence is all lined up against belief in God. By evidence, I mean the evidence out there, not the evidence in our hearts or minds. And I'm here to tell you today that there are strong empirical reasons that support our belief in God. Again, I want to emphasize, they're not proofs. I cannot show you in five easy steps that God absolutely exists. If I could, I would write a book and make millions, maybe even billions, showing you. I can show you that believing in God is a rational decision to the evidence. So here we go. It's going to be a little longer than normal. Hang in there. I know the service is also longer than normal, but this is important. Imagine that you're from Mongolia and you're walking through the hills of South Dakota for the first time and you know nothing about the United States and you come over the horizon and you see this. What would you make of it? What inference would you draw from what you see? I think the first inference you could make is that what you're looking at didn't come about by natural forces. There was an active, intelligent agency involved in creating this. Now, this active, intelligent agency has no taste, right? I find this demonstration garish in appearance. I wish they'd left the mountain the way it was, but the images themselves, it's no doubt they were created by an active intelligence. I think any person from anywhere in the world, from any time in history, if they came upon this scene, would recognize that there was an intelligent agent who created this. Who exactly? Well, maybe not know. Why? Certainly not know either. But that there was an intelligent intent behind this vista or anything like it is absolutely true. The question I ask you today is, how do you know this? How do you know this? What mental processes are at work in you and me that would allow us to draw this kind of inference? Human beings seem to have the innate ability to recognize the difference between naturally occurring phenomenon and those that occur through intelligent agents. I put up two examples of bridges. There's a naturally occurring bridge, an archway, and then there's an intelligently created bridge, one that came from intelligence, a certain intelligence, human intelligence in this case. How do we know the difference between the two? I mean, it is theoretically possible that Mount Rushmore or that second bridge there could have been created by natural forces. It's remotely possible. It's almost statistically zero. It's so improbable that we just dismiss it out of hand. We know when something's been created instinctively. We see it and we know it. We don't understand the processes, the thinking processes behind this that allows us to make these kinds of inferences. It's a mystery. I've never seen any explanation for how we do this. When an ancient stone, and I got another slide up there, when an ancient stone you find an ancient stone with markings on it, it's very easy to recognize that the markings on the stone are a form of language. They are patterns of symbols. They have meaning embedded in them. They're not random, naturally indiscriminate markings on that piece of stone. We may not be able to decipher what the meaning is. We may never know what the meaning is, but that there is meaning, we do know. We use this kind of inference to scan the skies looking for extraterrestrial signals. SETI, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence, is based on the principle that we can infer and recognize intelligent signals in life. That's what we're doing. We're looking for some intelligent radio signals out in all the noise of the universe. If we can find some repeated pattern from repeated design patterns in the sounds that come to us, then we have discovered another intelligence out there in the universe. If we didn't have this ability, SETI and things like it would make no sense. Now imagine being outdoors and seeing a chain of dominoes in front of you running from horizon to horizon. Ah, there it is right there. Beyond your line of sight, from either direction, this line of dominoes right across. And you see from one side that the dominoes are cascading towards you as one domino falls over another. I think you can make a basic inference in the moment. Even though you can't see beyond the horizon, somewhere way out there beyond your sight line, the cascade of falling dominoes got its first start. It had a beginning. How did it get started? Well, the simplest explanation is someone knocked over the first domino. You can't prove that, of course, but that's an easy inference to make. An infinite line of dominoes that just happen to be cascading across makes no sense to us. Someone knocked over the first domino to get that whole sequence going. After that, it's not hard to explain. One domino knocks over the next one, which knocks over the next one. Those dominoes that are knocking over each other are called contingent actions. They rely on the previous action. One hits the other, that's contingent. But what got the first action going? That's called a necessary act. Without the first domino falling over, the rest can't continue the series. So how did the series get started? How did that first domino get knocked over? That's, as I say, called the necessary act. Without it, the whole sequence doesn't work. It all rests on that first one getting knocked over. Now, 100 years ago, all the astronomers, and cosmologists believed that the universe was infinite in duration. An extending domino dominoes going off in either direction forever. They believed that the universe existed in a state of equilibrium. It was called the steady state theory. The understanding was not based on any scientific evidence, but rather based on a philosophical point of view. But then discoveries were made. And it became obvious over time that the universe was not infinite. It had a beginning. Beyond a horizon, there was a beginning. In fact, we have with some confidence, we can actually go back in time. We can go back right to the moment before it got started, right to that moment that we call the Big Bang, right to the moment when the second domino tips over onto the third. This was an enormous shock in the scholarly world. Einstein hated the idea of a universe with a beginning. The astronomer Fred Hoyle hated the idea as well. In fact, most astronomers hated the idea. Most philosophers hated the idea of a universe with an absolute beginning. In fact, it was Hoyle who coined the phrase the Big Bang. He used it derisively as an insult against the idea of a universe with a start. He was a proponent of that steady state theory, the universe, an infinite universe with no beginning, no end. See, because the idea of an absolute start for the universe brings all sorts of questions that make atheistic-leaning scientists nervous. The astronomer and physicist Robert Jastrow, who worked for NASA, put it this way: for the scientist who has lived by his faith in the power of reason, the story ends like a bad dream. He has scaled the mountain of ignorance. He is about to conquer the highest peak. As he pulls himself over the final rock, he is greeted by a band of theologians who have been sitting there for centuries. The idea of a universe with a beginning seemed all too close to these words. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. There's been a large amount of work over the last 40 years trying to undo the implications of a universe having a beginning. New theories that try to postulate a universe without a beginning. Or there's something called the multiverse theory. Most of the proposals only push the problem back a step or two. They don't really resolve the issue. None of them can fully escape the need for a necessary cause to get everything going, to get things started. How did it all get started? What pushed the first domino over onto the second? Why is there something instead of nothing? A strong candidate for the necessary cause of the universe is God. It's God. It's a totally rational act to believe that there was someone or something that caused the universe to come into existence, to knock over that first domino that got everything else started. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light. Now, it's one thing to get a universe started, but how do you get a universe that can sustain life, especially intelligent life? And that requires an extreme fine-tuning of the forces that govern the universe. Imagine a universe creating machine on a space station deep in space, kind of like a soundboard. You might have a picture of a soundboard there, well, filled with dials and sliders. If you go back, you can see that ours is kind of like that too, not quite as big. All these fun little things to push in that. Imagine that these sliders and dials controlled all the necessary physical parameters of the forces that allow life. And if you change one parameter, life is gone. Perhaps even the universe itself is gone. There's another picture. Go to the next picture, please. This is from Stephen Meyer's book, The Return of the God Hypothesis. He sketched out a simple example of the creation, universe creating machine. These parameters include the gravitational force, the initial state of disorder of the universe, the electromagnetic force, the strong nuclear force, the weak nuclear force, the expansion rate of the universe. The expansion rate of the universe has a tolerance of 10 to the 24th power. That means it's 1 to the sextillionth degree of precision is needed to get the right kind of universe for life. In fact, if you go to the next slide, you can see how big a number that is. If you adjust the dial that controls the expansion rate of the universe by more than 1 sextillionth, I think there's such a word actually, but it puts everything out of order. There's no life. There may not even be a universe, because the universe either expands too quickly or not quickly enough. It expands too quickly and disperses, or it doesn't expand quickly enough and it collapses on itself and is gone. 1 sextillionth of a degree. In fact, if you go back to that little diagram we had, Liz, each one of those fine-tuning parameters are exquisitely precise, beyond anything we can fathom humanly speaking. It's mind-bogglingly precise. And I have a quote up there that maybe hopefully Liz can get to. And this is why Fred Hoyle said, and I mentioned this quote last week, a common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics as well as with chemistry and biology. How do you get that degree of precision? Does it happen randomly? I don't think so. So now we have two reasonably strong inferences for God. They're not hard proofs, but they're two reasonably common sense reasons for believing in God, why many scientists believe in God. We need a first cause for the universe, someone that knocks over that first domino, and then we need someone or something to explain the precisely fine-tuned forces at work in the universe necessary for life. These all seem suspiciously intended, or as Hoyle says, someone's been monkeying around with them. And then we look at the Earth. You know, we take the Earth for granted. It's a nice place to live, don't you think? It's pretty hospitable overall. Maybe not this morning so much, but it's pretty hospitable. But the more we reflect on the necessary conditions of a planet for life, the more remarkable the Earth becomes. The world of Star Trek, a world that I quite love, was built on the ideas of Carl Sagan. Sagan postulated a Milky Way galaxy and universe that was filled with life, teeming with life, incredibly hospitable to life, with multitudes of planets like the Earth. That's why Star Trek has so many different alien civilizations in it. Sagan based his view on the idea that the only criteria necessary for life on a planet is liquid water. A planet needs water to sustain life. It needs to be in the sweet spot of the sun, too. You got to get the right amount of energy. If it's too hot, the water burns away. If it's too cold, the water freezes. No, you need liquid water to make it all work. But today we know that there are many other necessary features that a planet needs to have in order to sustain life. It not only needs liquid water, but it needs the right type of sun. It gives the right amount of energy for the right type of time. You need a sun that burns for a long time at a decent level of energy, which makes almost all the stars of our Milky Way ineligible to be a candidate for that kind of planet. See, most of the stars in the galaxy aren't like ours. They're red dwarfs. They won't work. You need tectonic plates on a planet so that it turns over the crust again and again and again. You need a planet that rotates at a certain speed, at a certain angle, to distribute the heat and energy through the whole ecosystem. You need a planet that lives with a neighbor like Jupiter, a giant planet in the outer solar system that sucks up all the asteroids and comets so that the Earth-like planet isn't bombarded with these things and destroys life as it gets going. You need a planet in the right part of the galaxy. See, Earth is out in one of those arms, those spiral arms. That's a good place to be for a planet that wants to host life. If you go too close to the center of our galaxy, where most of the stars are, where most of the planets are, it's too close. There's too much radiation for life to take hold. In the book, The Privileged Planet, the authors list 10 planetary conditions necessary for intelligent life. That seems pretty reasonable. 10 characteristics for life, and the authors give each characteristic a 1 in 10 chance. That seems pretty reasonable number. Pretty cautious number, actually. And that means if there are 10 planetary characteristics necessary for life, and each characteristic has a 1 in 10 chance, that means any planet we come across in our search today has a 1 in 10 to the 10 chance of being hospitable for life. That's a big number. That's 1 over 10 billion. But the estimate today is there's 100 billion planets in the galaxy. That means there's possibly 10 planets like Earth in our galaxy that can host life. Maybe not at the level of Star Trek, but not insignificant. But here's the thing, and we talked a bit about this a few years back. The list of 10 planetary characteristics necessary for life is only the beginning. I saw one list that had 168 necessary characteristics for life. A planet had to have these 198 characteristics for life to take hold. I saw one list go above 200, not 10. That would mean if there were 200 characteristics necessary for life, that there wouldn't be one planet in the whole universe capable of supporting life. Statistically speaking, the chance of any planet in the whole universe being able to sustain life as we know it is pretty much zero. The fact that we have one is a miracle. Now, does that prove that God, does the earth prove that God exists? No. But it does look like another setup job to me. It just shouldn't be here. The earth shouldn't be here. But it is. And how do we explain it? So I think we have three now reasonably strong inferences for God. Not proofs, God as the first cause of the universe, the extreme fine-tuning of the universe, and the unlikely, almost remotely possible planetary conditions necessary for life. You see, one of the great mysteries of life is life. Where did life come from? How did it arise? How did inorganic material become a living system? Today, origins of life researchers are looking for a strictly naturalist explanation for the first life. But the problem for such an explanation has only grown over time. The gap between inorganic material and living systems is enormous. That gap has gone wider and wider and wider. 150 years ago, we thought cells were just blobs. Today, we understand that the simplest cell is an immensely complicated system, like the most highly sophisticated factory we could ever imagine. As I say, that means it's becoming more and more difficult to explain how inorganic and even organic material like amino acids assemble into a living system like a cell. The threshold that needs to be crossed has become larger and larger and larger. Now, one of the most remarkable developments in science in the past 100 years has been the discovery of DNA. And there are two key takeaways to DNA to think about today. The first is that DNA is a self-replicating system. It can reproduce itself. DNA is self-reproducible. That means once you get life going, it can sustain itself. DNA builds proteins. Proteins are the foundation of life. They do the basic work of life. These proteins are called enzymes. No proteins, no enzymes, no life. DNA assembles amino acids into a chain. The chain, when finished, is a protein. Proteins are usually 150 to 300 amino acids long. The sequence has to be perfect. If there's one mistake along the process, if there's one amino acid that doesn't fit in properly, the whole thing doesn't work. It won't function. There are around 20,000 proteins, different kinds of proteins in the human body. We have different genes made up of different DNA that are designed to code for these proteins. 20,000 different DNA assemblies to code for the proteins that we need to live. The simplest hypothetical cell scientists can today imagine has to have at least 55 proteins in it. That means we have to have 55 different DNA structures to produce 55 different proteins. Now here's, as you've been looking at, a picture of a typical DNA structure. This is actually a simplification of it, to be honest. This is an extremely sophisticated construction. If you read about the chemistry of DNA, it is incredibly sophisticated in how it's organized. So sophisticated that we're not even remotely close to being able to reconstruct it in our laboratories. It's far, far, far beyond our capacity to reconstruct, even with our technologies. Do you think a system like this could come about through random processes? I mean, seriously. It seems completely implausible to me that DNA, the foundation of physical life for us in this world, could come about through a random process. Something so sophisticated could be assembled in a random set of circumstances. And that gets us to our second takeaway. DNA is a code. It's a code. It has specified information in it. Bill Gates says that DNA is like a computer program, but far more sophisticated than anything we've ever created. Stephen Meyer, the philosopher, stated that when we come across embedded specified information like a code or like stones with markings on them that are obviously language symbols, or we hear a repeating signal from another star that sends a radio signal to us that we can decipher as intelligible, or a computer code that allows our computers to function. When we see that kind of embedded, specified information, we instinctively infer a natural intelligence behind it, just like we did with Mount Rushmore or the bridge or that stone with those inscriptions. Could we not also infer this in the DNA structures that are the foundations of life? Fred Hoyle, an atheist, said it this way: indeed, such a theory, origins of a life rising through an intelligent agent, is so obvious that one wonders why it's not widely accepted as being self-evident. The reasons are psychological rather than scientific. With respect to the origins of life, what is needed is a first cause. Even Darwin recognized this. Someone who knocks over that first domino of life, gets it all started, assembles that first bit of DNA that allows life to reproduce itself, to allow life to evolve on our planet. And it seems to me that God is a reasonable candidate for this. So now we have four inferences for God. Again, they're not proofs. My goal is not to show you proofs. My goal is to show you that your belief in God is rational. It's a rational decision to make in the face of the evidence. You can be a rational theist in 2022. Our belief, our faith runs with the evidence, not against it. So we have God as the first cause of the universe, and we have the extreme fine-tuning of the universe for life. We have the unlikely planetary conditions necessary for life, and now we have God as the first cause for life on Earth. Now, if God does tip over that first domino for life, then the question comes about how that variety of life that we experience today comes about. How did it arise on Earth? Most of us have been taught that life has evolved on Earth through strictly naturalistic processes. That's what my grade 11 biology teacher taught me. Probably yours too, most of you at least. That was Darwin's hypothesis back in 1859. Over time, his hypothesis has evolved. We now call it natural selection working on genetic mutation. The idea is very simple. Genes mutate. We know this for a fact. They mutate. Most mutations are harmful, yes, but occasionally you can get a good mutation that makes the organism more viable for life. So, for instance, you get this mutation that makes you run faster than everybody else. That means when some predator comes to you, you're outrunning everybody else. They're the ones getting eaten. And you're able to reproduce, and eventually, over time, that trait gets brought into the whole community of people or species, that species. Over time, enough of these traits come about, they develop so that a new species arises, a species distinct from its former self. Darwin proposed that this process was incremental over long periods of time. A slow, laborious process for sure, but the Earth is, after all, 4.5 billion years old, and life's been on the planet for 4 billion years, perhaps. So it's a long time. But here's the problem. The fossil evidence does not support Darwin's proposal. Paleontologists know this. They know this. We should have an almost infinite number of intermediate life forms, but they don't exist in the fossil record. The history of life does not demonstrate gradual transformation of species as Darwin predicted. The paleontologist Stephen Stanley acknowledges, he says this: the known fossil record offers no evidence that the gradualistic model can be valid. Rather, we know from fossil records that new species tend to arise full-blown without any prior antecedents. This runs completely against Darwin's proposal. How can that be? What are the mechanisms that allow species just to simply arrive? It's not natural selection working on genetic mutation. It can't be, because we understand how genetic mutation works. We understand the mathematics of it. Genetic mutation is just too slow to allow species just to pop out. A new species requires a new body plan. The new body plan requires new proteins. New proteins require new information. A new species, by default, requires new information. Where does this new information come from? Back in 2016, evolutionary scientists gathered in London, England, at the Royal Society to discuss evolutionary theory. They acknowledged openly that the current theory wasn't working. The modern synthesis, that's what Darwin's theory is called today, the modern synthesis doesn't work. Natural selection working on genetic mutation does not account for the variety of life that we experience today. What you and I were taught in our grade 11 biology class is no longer accepted in the at the far reaches of our scientific community today. Darwin has not come up with a viable explanation for how new species arise, which was his goal when he wrote his book back in 1859. How species survive, yes, but how they arrive, no. Survival of the fittest, yes. Arrival of the fittest, no. There is today a movement at foot to develop a new theory of evolution. It's called the extended evolutionary synthesis. The goal of this approach is to find new mechanisms in addition to natural selection working on genetic mutation that can explain the rise of species. But so far, nothing has become a good candidate as a mechanism that explains how life arises and how species develop, how species arrive on the scene. Now, I'll admit to you that that group of scientists who met back in London in 2016 are not looking for God as an explanation for how new species arise. God is not going to enter into their models. I promise you that. But we're still stuck for an explanation. And then I think about Fred Hoyle's comment when he says this. He says the chance, and we mentioned this to you last week, the chance that higher life forms might have merged through evolutionary process is comparable with the chance that a tornado sweeping through a junkyard might assemble a Boeing 747 from material therein. What does this all mean? It means that God may be part of the ongoing development of life on planet Earth. The sociologist Rodney Stark wrote a fascinating article back in 2014. I have a couple of copies on the welcome table for those interested called Fact, Fable, and Darwin. In the article, he lays out some of the problems with Darwin's theory, problems that have only gotten worse over the past 20 years. Stark laid out the problem in a very easy way to understand, and he ends his article this way. He says this, "I believe that one day there will be a plausible theory of the origin of species. But if and when that occurs, there will be nothing in any such theory that makes it impossible to propose that the principles involved were not part of God's great design, any more than such a theory will demonstrate the existence of God. But while we wait, why not lift the requirement that high school texts enshrine Darwin's failed attempt as an eternal truth?" Now, I've attempted to show you four positive inferences that allow us to wholeheartedly believe in God, to show us that belief in God is a rational act. God is the first cause of the universe. God, the extreme fine-tuning of the universe for life, the most unlikely planetary conditions necessary for life on planet Earth, and God is the first cause for life on Earth. And I've shown you that one of the major barriers to believe in God has been removed. You see, because Darwin's hypothesis on evolution has been used as a rebuttal for belief in God. It's been used as a cudgel against believers over the past 150 years. There is reason to suppose, at least hypothetically, that a superintelligence is at work in life at the beginning and even today. People of faith today are in a strong position to positively and powerfully believe in God without apology, without fear that we're part of some irrational, flaky fringe community. Our faith and our belief collaborates with the best of the evidence available to us. It's not a foolproof, but it is solid and defendable. And what it allows me to do today is now to embrace the words that Paul says in Acts 17. He says these words. Let me just read them again to you. "The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth." Hallelujah. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. He's not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man, he made all the nations that they should inhabit the whole earth, and he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. And some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. I can say this, I can say the words of Paul in Acts with my heart and my soul and my head. And I invite you to do the same. Let's pray.